The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Public Accounts Committee. This morning we have the topic of the heating assistance rebate, and we have with us the Office of Service Nova Scotia. I'd like to remind everyone to place their phones on silent so we don't have interruptions. And we'll start with introductions, beginning with Mr. Rankin.
Ian Rankin, Timberley Prospect.
Good morning. My name is Tim Houston. I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning, Maureen McDonald, Halifax Needham.
Good morning, Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
Good morning, Brendan McGuire, Halifax Atlantic.
Good morning, Suzanne Lunas-Croft, Lunenburg.
Good morning, MLA for Sackville-Beaverbank.
Joachim Stronach, Halifax-Chebucto.
And my name is Alan McMaster. I'm your chair and MLA for Inverness. Would now like to give the department a chance for some opening remarks. And Ms. Munro, I believe we'll start with yourself.
Yes.
And also, if you could introduce your colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Joanne Munro, the Chief Executive Officer of Service Nova Scotia. And with me today are Scott Farmer, Associate Deputy Minister of Service Nova Scotia, Michelle McFarlane, Executive Director of Business and Consumer Services, Roger Gregg, Acting Director of Programs and Business Licensing, and Bernie Mayer, Director of Audit and Enforcement. I thank the committee members for giving us the opportunity to talk about a program that helps thousands of Nova Scotians with the high cost of heating their homes during the cold winter months. I'll begin my opening remarks with an overview of the Heating Assistance Rebate Program, which I will simply refer to as HARP. HARP is a very popular program, reaching 43,687 individuals and families across the province last year. The department provides a rebate of up to $200 toward home heating costs. The department starts accepting applications around the end of October, first part of November, and the amount of each rebate depends on the applicant's income or the total income of the household. Nova Scotians are eligible to receive a home heating rebate if they pay a heating bill at their current address and meet one of the following criteria. They live alone with an income of $27,000 or less. They live with others and have a combined income of $42,000 or less. They receive income assistance from the Department of Community Services, or they receive the guaranteed income supplement from Service Canada. HARP rebates can help no matter what type of heat someone has in their home. 63% of last year's recipients used oil, while 31% used electricity, the remaining 6% used other fuel types. HARP rebates are open to eligible Nova Scotians that own or rent their homes. Not only are we sending out about 44,000 pre-populated forms to people who applied the previous year, HARP applications are also found online by calling our public inquiries line and asking for an application to be mailed out at all Access Nova Scotia locations, Department of Community Services offices, all the MLA offices, and through more than 70 community groups, resource centers, and other locations across the province. The budget for HAARP is $11 million. Overall spending for the program has been steady over the past 5 years. And government spent $10.8 million in 2013 and 14 and $9.4 million last year. This year, as of February 9th, HAARP spending has reached $7 million, and we expect to receive more applications over the course of the winter. Government recently announced continued funding of the Good Neighbor Energy Fund administered by the Salvation Army. The contribution to the fund is part of the overall HAARP budget, and government is very pleased with how the Salvation Army has been running the program since 2008. This fund is different from HAARP because it offers financial assistance to low-income families to heat their home in emergency situations. Government's contribution to the fund for 2016 is up to $800,000. Last winter, 1,757 households received assistance through the fund. To receive support from the Good Neighbor Energy Fund, an applicant must not have received assistance from the program for the last 2 years. The eligibility period was 3 years last year, but has been reduced to two to help more low-income families. Next year is our intent to make it even more convenient to apply for HAARP by offering an online application process. Modernizing the program is part of Service Nova Scotia's digital strategy to make it easier for Nova Scotians to interact with government. We know that many, if not most, applicants have access to a mobile device. The reality is that using digital means faster and more convenient service for our clients, and it is more efficient and cost-effective for government. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank MLAs for being excellent ambassadors for HAARP. This is a program that all parties in the House of Assembly have shown tremendous support for. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks, and I'd be pleased to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Munro. We'll start with Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You mentioned that the program has an $11 million budget, and in your opening comments, I was trying to catch the numbers there, which were there. There were a few useful numbers, so I appreciate that.
Okay.
But you, I think you said that the program reached 43,687 people, and I just did some quick math on that. That would be an average of $251 per person to bring me up to $11 million. So can you maybe just give us some perspective on, is it 43, if it's 43, almost 44,000 people, what's the actual number of applicants? Because presumably some of those are families.
Yeah. In fact,
Ms. Munro?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. The 43,687 applicants, that is income, or that is individuals as well as families. So it's applications mm-hmm. processed. And I think it's important to note that in the $11 million, it's also included the $800,000 fund for JNEF, the Good Neighbor Energy Fund. And the $11 million was not fully spent last year. The $9.4 million was spent last year for last fiscal.
Okay, so based on all those numbers, mm-hmm. I think you get a number bigger than $11 million. If you take 43, almost 44,000 people, plus the Good Neighbor, plus what wasn't spent, the numbers just don't seem to jive there. So can you tell me how many applicants, tell me how many people receive funding from the program? So the most you can get is $200. Mm-hmm. If I take $11 million and divide it by 44,000, I get up to $251. Do you understand my question?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Munro?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $11 million as the base number is not the correct number to use. The correct number would be $9.4 million with 43,687 applicants. And then on top of that, there's the monies that were spent for Good Neighbor Energy Fund, which were 1,757 applicants.
Okay, what's the average payout to an applicant?
Average payout for that?
Yeah.
Could I defer to my colleague, Mr. Gregg?
Mr. Gregg.
Okay, it's up to $200, so it might average to be slightly under $200, but around $200 per rebate. So if you say roughly 44,000.
Do we have an actual number?
43,687.
Do we have an actual number?
Mr. Houston?
If we have an actual, some payouts would be $100, some would be $200. What's the average payout to applicant?
Mr. Gregg?
Yeah, it works out to be around, say, $195,000.
Okay, maybe that's a number we can kind of get as we're chatting here. I'm trying to understand how the money's being paid out. So maybe I'll go at it another way. Of the how much of the value of the fund, which did you say was 9.4 million last year? How much of that actually went to Nova Scotians, and how much went to administration of the fund?
Ms. Munro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. We can actually, back to your further question, we can actually get you the average paid out when you take into account the sliding scale of 200, 150, or 125. So we can provide that to the committee. In answer to your question, $9.4 million was spent out last year for the HARP program. The administration of the program last year was $613,000.
Okay. Is that included in the 9.4?
Yes.
Okay, so 9.4 was the whole value, and 600,000 was administration, and the administration would be people advertising. What would the administration be?
Ms. Munro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The administration of $613,000. It is a manual process, so the majority of that administration is temporary help to process the applications, and that equates to $313,000, $320,000, which was the clerical spend for last year in bringing in those temporary help. And the other portions of that are some of the hard costs, which is postage. Postage was $130,000 last year. Printing was $32,000 last year for the applications. There was an advertising spend, which we have reduced over the course of time, down to $57,000 last year from previous years of $70,000 plus.
Just you mentioned the postage $130,000, just more of a curiosity. I know that they come with prepaid envelopes. Mm-hmm. Do you pay when those envelopes hit the mail, or do you pay the prepaid postage on that just when the envelope? Because there'd be a ton of these things that aren't used at the end of the day. Is all those postage paid?
Ms. Munro?
Thank you. Yes, it's prepaid postage. So what we do is we send out pre-populated applications for those previous applicants from the year before. So there's 44,000 pre-populated application forms sent out to previous applicants. And in that, there is a postage paid envelope for that applicant to send back their application.
So how many packages would you have put together to send out? So you mentioned 44,000, but presumably you run some extra too. Like how many packages would be prepared?
Ms. Munro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow on to the last question, we are only charged for what is actually mailed.
Okay.
So that is the answer to the question.
Okay. So is the $600,000 cost to administer a $9.4 million program, is that efficient?
Ms. Munro?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From our research, in looking at programs to administer, programs such as this, administration between 6 and 12% of the overall budget is in line and considered to be efficient.
Okay, and of the 44,000 people, how many households is there? I'm just unclear if is that actually 44,000 residences, or is it 20,000 residents of two people each?
Ms. Munro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The program is offered to both families and individuals, so the $44,000 or $43,687 is a combination of both individuals and family households. So the breakdown of that, I'm looking to my right here, do we have the breakdown of the split between individual applicants and family applicants?
Sorry, Mr. Gregg.
It's roughly a 50-50 split between families and individuals for who receives the rebate. Where we have a bit of a challenge of giving an exact number is that if you apply through social assistance to receive the guaranteed income supplement, you don't get recorded as having either a family status or an individual status. You have a guaranteed income supplement status, or you would have an income assistance status. But it's around a 50-50 split between the individuals and the households for who receives the rebate.
Okay. I think I'm just having a little difficulty articulating my questions this morning. If, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that one individual person applies and one household applies, that is two applications, but the household has six people living in it. Do we call that seven people, or do we call that two?
Two rebates that go out.
Okay. So now, in terms of the overall use of the program, which sounds like it's going down, I think we said it was 7 million so far this year versus last year. In total, at the end, there was 9.4 million. How does that 7 million as of February 7th compare to where it was last year? Is it up or down?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. Applications processed and paid today are up approximately 3% from this time last year.
Okay. So, and the year before, it was, did you say it was 9.8 the year before or 10.8? I couldn't remember. Yeah, like in terms of use total budget for the program.
Ms. Monroe?
Excuse me, 9.4 million.
No, so and then the year before that?
10.8.
Okay, so it went 10.8 and then it went down to 9.4, and this year you say you're within kind of 3% of that. So what do you make of that the whole budget's not being used? Can you read anything into that?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the question. The budget is set at $11 million. It is set with a buffer. And the buffer is to ensure that we're able to not turn anybody away, first off, in case there is a very harsh winter, higher heating costs, or if there's a want to change the parameters of the program. So there has been a buffer set, and the established budget for the last couple of years has been $11 million. The fact that it has not been fully used, I think it's to ensure that there is enough for unexpected use, if you will. The dollars that are not used within the HARP budget at the end of the fiscal, and we never know how many applicants we have until the end of the program, is sent back into central government as savings to government. It's not used for any other purpose within Service Nova Scotia.
Okay, thank you. And so is there a concern that $11 million budget will decrease this year?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you repeat the question?
So if the budget's been $11 million the last couple of years, but it hasn't been fully subscribed, is there any reason to be concerned that as we'll have a new budget in the next couple of months, presumably, what do you suspect will happen to the budget for this program?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are in the budget process, and I know that the support for the HARP program is there. I do not have any insight as to what's going to happen with the actual overall budget.
So I think the...
But our intent for Service Nova Scotia is to reach as many Nova Scotians as we can with the program, and I think we all know that there's always the balance of priorities overall in government, but we have had the $11 million, and in the past it has been used, and we've never had an issue where we've, from my understanding and history, that we've never gone over the requested budget authority.
Okay, so I think when you look at a program like this, you look at is the need there, mm-hmm. and then I would say the need is there. So then, if it's not being subscribed, the question becomes: is it not known about, mm-hmm. or what about the eligibility requirements? Mm-hmm. And then the third part would be: is it too difficult to navigate? So I mean, in this case, the fact that this is that you see it decreasing. Mm-hmm. Whereas my sense from being around the community is the need would be increasing. I'm wondering why it is. Is it that people don't know about this, or is it that people are not eligible? Have you, when's the last time, to your knowledge, that the eligibility requirements of this program have been changed?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. The eligibility program, the eligibility of the program has not changed since 2009, when the program was introduced. The thresholds were set based on the low income cutoff parameters, which are established out of StatsCan in looking at low income families and individuals. So we use those as our benchmark in setting those thresholds. At $42,000 for families and $27,000 for individuals. When we look at the thresholds and the actual rebate, it would be nice to increase the threshold. And to give you a sense, if we increase the threshold or increase the rebate from $200 to $250, the cost of the program will increase by about $2.3 million. So the parameters and the program is always being looked at to be modernized and to change in line with the other priorities that we have.
Thank you for that. And I guess in between, you could bump up to 225 and pretty much use the budget. We didn't really get the average, but it's one of the reasons I was wondering about that. But in terms of the eligibility for this program, hasn't changed since 2009. Probably somebody is looking at it from time to time to see if there's scope to change it. But we do have in the news recently changes around the PharmaCare program. Which will be income tested, similar to this. Has there been any discussions internally as to how those two things can jive, or did anyone in your department say, wait a second, maybe we should be? There might be some synergies to gain there. Is it something that you've considered?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. At this time, there has been no discussion on synergies between those two programs.
Okay, but is it something that it popped into your mind, but just hasn't been fully reviewed yet, or just it's a separate program, it's a separate way to do it?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our mandate is to focus on the heating assistance rebate program, and at this point, there has not been any discussion around the PharmaCare program and the HEART program.
Okay. Of the 44,000 people that use this program, how many would be considered seniors?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The demographic of the HEART program is that there's 52% are seniors that use this program, and 35% are demographic of 41 to 64-year-old, and then 10% are 26 to 40 years old.
Okay. If you had somebody come into the program that's a senior, and they used the program last year, this year you would prepare a package for them with prepaid postage and send that out to them, and they would work through the forms and get it back to you. Mm-hmm. Is there an opportunity to automate all that if the changes with the PharmaCare proceed and become income tested? The government would already know if a person is eligible or not. Could they not just put them back in with minimal administration? I'm just wondering how we can you can probably, there's probably something to piggyback off that. I'm surprised if you haven't spoke, if you thought about that yet.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, with we have partnered with Housing Nova Scotia as well as Energy on Efficiency Nova Scotia with our application forms in 44,000. So we are looking for ways to support other programs through those mailouts and sharing information around programs that make that target market aware of programs within the Housing Department for making their homes more accessible. As well as Efficiency Nova Scotia in sharing information so that that program can actually proactively assist our target client group here. So there is work and collaboration with other departments. And at this point in time, there has not been conversation around pharmacare. The HARP program is an efficiency initiative that we use for home heating in a very targeted group for the low-income Nova Scotians.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Houston, you have just 1 minute remaining.
Okay, thank you. I'll just finish up with asking, if the 44,000 people that were in the program this year, how many of those would have been in the program last year? I'm wondering about the level of consistency.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 44,000 mailouts, there was 43,647. The new applicants last year were around 6,100 applicants that came in, and the remainder were repeat applicants. To follow on the other question, too, around modernizing the program, I did mention in my opening remarks that we are looking to put the program online and build that out for both our clients, but as well for efficiencies with government. And there will be a use through technology in order to do a direct deposit back to the applicant. So our intent is to make it easier and more convenient for all applicants on the go forward.
Thank you. Move to Ms. McDonald.
Thank you very much. Just in a general way, you started in your opening comments by saying it's a very popular program, but I'm wondering what the department's view of the program is in terms of how worthwhile a program it is.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I can say that for the department and for myself, personally, this is a very worthwhile program and one that helps the most vulnerable in our community. So we look to the program and the review of the program on an ongoing basis on how to improve, make it better. So it is a program I think all Nova Scotians support, and certainly MLAs have supported. We really feel that our strategic partners in this program right across the province are hugely important in getting the word out and is our key awareness build for this program. So MLA offices, as well as our community groups and services, and the Salvation Army through the JNEF Emergency Fund Program.
Thank you. I note that your opening remarks also indicated that the Good Neighbor program will be topped up to 800,000 this year, which is where it's been in previous years, has it not? I think last year was the only year that it didn't receive 800,000 as a transfer from this fund. Is that correct?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, the transfer was $400,000, and as the program is required, they report back on an annual basis as to the money spent, as well as to the reserves that they have on. And there was a reserve that was built up, and so that was the reason why the $400,000 was sent and not the full $800,000. But the authority is an $800,000 support for the program.
Which is bringing it back to where it's been 10, 11, 11, 12, 13, 14, and probably beyond that. So when I look at the funds allocated to the program, the funds spent, and the actual number of rebates that have gone out, I see some things that concern me. So the funds allocated to the program, let's say in starting in 10-11, 14.9 million, 10.5 million were spent, and there were 50,100 rebates. In 11-12, again, 14.9 million was allocated, 11.9 million was spent, and there were 51,000 rebates. In 12-13, there were the monies allocated went down by $1 million, 13.1 million. 11 million was spent, which is consistent with the previous year, and 48,400 rebates. And then in 13-14, again, $13.1 million allocated, 10.8 million spent, 46,600 rebates. And then last year, the amount allocated was reduced to $11 million from 13.1. And of that, 11 million, only 9.6 was spent, with only 44,000 rebates. So we're seeing a significant drop in the numbers of people who are receiving the rebate. So can you explain what your analysis tells you why there is that drop-off?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. When we look at the rebates, the first point would be the number of applicants in that, you know, on the cusp of the threshold, so 42 and 27,000 and close to that. If there's a small increase or, you know, a minimal increase in their salary, it's around 5 and 6% that fall off the eligibility criteria. So there's that, the back end where we have the 5 to 6% that fall off, and then coming in the lower end of the threshold. There's been a number of changes that we've seen or that we are looking at. First would be back in 2008, rental properties comprised about 29% of the new housing starts. Fast forward to last year, and 80% of new housing starts or new residential home starts were rental properties. So we see individuals moving into the rental properties, and if they do not pay for their heat, they do not qualify for the program. So I think that that's another area where we're seeing maybe reduced numbers. Lastly, on the seniors population, there is obviously a trend or a demographic where seniors are moving out of their primary homes or downsizing. If they move into a long-term care facility or into a rental property, which seems to be the trend, and they're not paying for heat, that would as well impact the number of people coming in to apply for the application or apply for the program. I would say that our analysis our analysis around the numbers has been steady. There is a decline, but we think part of that is due to some of the inflows and outflows of the demographics. Our job is, though, to help get the word out and use our public awareness programs and initiatives and advertising and maybe change ways that we advertise to be more effective that way, but to continue to engage our ambassadors for the program.
Can you tell me about your advertising budget for this program last year? How much was allocated? How much was spent? And how does that relate to advertising in prior years?
Mr. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. On the advertising spend, this program traditionally had been based on print and radio advertising. So in 2013 and 14, the spend was $70,000. We've started to move toward more digital advertising and online ads and some print, and that brought the advertising spend down to $53,000. And then this year, our estimate is that we're going to be around $50,000. So the move, I think, is trying to get away from more expensive advertising into social media and to digital. And so far, you know, work with our Facebook and Twitter. The infographics on Twitter have received about over 12,000 impressions and over 50 retweets. So we're trying to be more effective in our advertising spend. And in fact, this year we'll be able to track the analytics about who's actually applied into the program, the analytics that come back from our digital and social media spend. So we're working very hard to get more bang for our buck on the advertising spend, but primarily our pre-populated forms and our stakeholders and ambassadors around the province help us in this regard.
So advertising has actually been reduced by about $80,000 then. Is that not the case? From $130,000.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My what I have here is in 2012, the spend was $140,000, and we're now looking at 2015 and 16 to be in the neighborhood of $50,000 estimate for the end of the fiscal.
So it's a significant reduction in your advertising spending. You indicated that there's a 3% increase in the number of applicants in the department at this time over last year. My understanding is that as of January the 22nd, there were 29,949 applications in the department. That leaves quite a gap between how many rebates were sent out last year, if we were to just hit that target of 44,000. Is it the case that you get a big flurry of activity in February and March? Will that gap be filled?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could defer for this question to have my colleague, Mr. Gregg, answer the call around the volume or the flow of applications and the timing.
Mr. Gregg.
So as part of our direct advertising, we send out pre-populated application forms to everyone who received the rebate the year before. So those mail-outs will take place just before the program launches. So what we'll see is an initial influx of applications that come in at the start of the program, and then they will start to taper off as the program continues. So as you say, if we look at week 9, we're at about 29,000 in. As of last week, we had 33,600 applications. So where we're looking to be on pace for, you know, around 44,000, similar to last year, that we'll see a sort of, it'll slowly peter. There might be a bit spike at the end for follow-ups and people trying to make the deadline, but it's leveling off.
What's the proportion of first-time applicants versus repeat applicants then? Of these applications you're getting?
Well, what we track is when the application comes in, we can track to see if it was sent pre-pop or if it was sent as a new application. And we see about 28% that come in are new applications, whereas the remaining 72 would be the pre-populated application forms.
Okay. And I have a question about applications that are rejected. How many applications do you get? What proportion are rejected?
Mr. Gregg?
Last year it was about 6%.
How many does that turn out to be?
It was about 2,595.
2,595? And this would be, the rejection would be based on what?
Mr. Gregg?
Primarily, it's income, not meeting the income thresholds. There's two pieces. You have to prove you pay for heat, or you'd have to meet an income threshold.
And how many of those rejected applications would have been people who would have qualified in a prior year?
Mr. Gray?
That's not information that we track with
you don't
the program.
Have that information. Okay, thank you. I'm also interested to know a bit more about the guaranteed income supplement and seniors. There are a large number of seniors who receive this rebate. I think as many as 23,500 seniors. Of those, how many are in receipt of the guaranteed income supplement?
Mr. Gregg?
That's a difficult question to answer because it depends on how you apply. With our application process, you have to prove you meet the income qualifications. If you're a senior and you receive the income, let's say you're an individual senior, you make $22,000 a year, you receive the guaranteed income supplement. However, you could still just apply and sign off and say you meet the income requirements. So there's a large group that will probably receive the income supplement, but we wouldn't record it because they would just come in as qualifying for the income.
So that's not something that you can provide really detailed analysis.
We couldn't give an accurate number on how many seniors who received the program received GIS. Some seniors, and it works out to be about, say, 5% of applicants are recorded as GIS qualified, but there'd be many others who receive the income supplement. They just already meet the income threshold, so we wouldn't have that recorded.
There's also a small number of recipients of this program who are on income assistance. Is there not?
Yes, there are.
Around 4,000?
Mr. Gregg?
that number sounds about right, but I could get some specific numbers back to you.
How closely do you work with the Department of Community Services around the parameters of this program and their requirements?
We're always trying to promote the program, and we work with the Department of Community Services. So when social assistance checks go out in December, we have a mail out that promotes the HARP program to all those recipients so that they can get in contact with us and hopefully send us an application.
Has there ever been any conversations with community services with respect to the rather significant amounts of money they pay annually for overpayments to Nova Scotia Power?
No, we have not had those conversations.
I want to ask a bit about the administration as well. In 14-15, the department, Service Nova Scotia, the expenses were $5.2 million. This is the entire department, I take it, lower than estimated. And the heating assistance rebate program was under budget with administrative savings, I think, of $3.6 million. Is that accurate? I have a briefing note from the department on this, and it just struck me as being rather skewed.
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat the numbers one more time for me?
So in 2014-15, Service Nova Scotia's expenses were $5.2 million, or 5.1% lower than estimated, due to underspending in the Heating Assistance Repaid Program, HARP, of $1.6 million, and general operating and salary savings of $3.6
million. Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $9.6 million, the number that's in my head is really about the authority of the budget and what was actually spent. On the administrative costs, as previously mentioned, that $613,000, the majority of that, 50% plus, is to bring in temporary staff to manually process these applications and get them into the database. And then there's the hard costs of postage, print, and so on and so forth. The move to try to provide convenience for our client base is important, but there is a real cost saving to those annual administrative costs that we are going to want to get at. And I can elaborate on that for you. I'm not clear on where that other reconciliation is coming from, and certainly would be happy to look into it for you, but I can't recollect that off the top of my head. But the intent for the modernizing of the program and getting it online is to be more convenient and as well to save money, and in fact to stand up an online system is around $60,000. And if we had just a 25% uptake, the annual savings is $90,000. The larger the uptake, the reduced amount of administrative costs. So at 40%, you're looking at about $160,000 annually for savings on the administration of this program. So there's a reason to go forward to provide a more convenient online application process and trim back on the processing manually of this program.
Ms. McDonald, you just have a few seconds remaining.
Thank you. I will pass my seconds to my colleagues.
Okay. We'll begin with Mr. Rankin, the Liberal Caucus.
Thank you. And I guess that's interesting discussion around the administration and the $613,000. Has that amount stayed roughly the same over the last 2 years, or has it, in terms of the actual value in itself, or the percentage of the total package that you're spending on administration?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. The costs to administer this program have remained
stable.
Very stable over the last number of years, but doesn't mean we can't improve it by modernizing the program.
Okay. I'm just wondering if you can quantify any other efficiency gains that you've been able to achieve, particularly over the last couple of years, in terms of application processing and how fast the applications are turned around and things like that.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. The team is always looking to make better the program, make it more efficient. In fact, there was a situation, there was a number of around 65%, if I recall, of let's say it touched more than once, so callbacks and follow-ups because the processes were not complete. So in that analysis and look-see, it was discovered that there was two signatures required because of a CRA requirement, and the team worked with CRA to develop the new program going forward, so only one signature was required. And in that efficiency move, we reduced the number of second touches down to I think it was well below, what was the number? 11%. So a significant improvement on how many times there was back and forth on a particular file. As well, MLA offices, a lot of people go to MLA offices to apply. We're able to then receive in faxed application forms, where previously that was not the case, so that's helped as well, although we want to get away from faxes. So there's been a number of efficiencies built over time with the process we have, which is manual, so not the best.
Okay. And I'm just curious, with each applicant, do they have to reapply every year no matter what, or is there any case possible for automating, you know, the ones that we are pretty positive that they're going to be remaining in that income threshold. Like, and I'm just thinking again of efficiencies of the administrator in the program.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the question. There's no way at this time to just put an automatic process in for applicants. It is unfortunately done every year to make sure that the criteria has been met for the applicant to be approved.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll move to Mr. Stroink.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I guess I just kind of want to touch base on the seniors, and just for the record, you said 52%, but I think it's 54% of seniors actually use the... I just want that to be just notified in the record for that. With that, I kind of want to touch on the seniors, as the seniors seem to be the largest group of people using this rebate. How is the department reaching out to those people better than the mailouts? Because most of those seniors probably are not computer savvy, and I'm assuming that that demographic is just going to grow as the seniors increase here in Nova Scotia. So what kind of mechanisms are you using to ensure that seniors are reached and touched and to know that this program's out there?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Our research actually shows that one of the fast and growing demographics for using tablets is the senior population. So in fact, to say that we might not be able to reach them through digital is something I think that we continue need to research and understand our user group. And so we always will be doing that. We'll be doing user research. Over and above our strategy to move into digital and to communicate through social media and so forth, we do have the traditional methods for advertising. Last year, we actually used our digital screens at Tim Hortons as well to talk to the client base at Tim Hortons, which seniors do enjoy a cup of coffee there, as well as our access centers. We used our access centers' digital screens as well to communicate. But I think the most important and effective use has been the pre-populated forms and going to MLA offices where there's conversations that go on around how they can apply and how they can help. We also advertised in the seniors' senior living and work with the seniors department to get the word out around the heating assistance rebate program as well, and our community groups who are hugely involved in our senior population are very key to communicating the HARP program and those that would be eligible. So it's very important to not leave anybody behind, and so we're committed to that.
Thank you for your answer. I guess my other kind of follow-up question to that is, have you seen the numbers grow in the seniors program in the last few years? Like, is it a number that continues to increase? And the other demographics that you mentioned, are they decreasing or increasing as well?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I'd asked my colleague, Mr. Gregg, to talk to the demographic trends that we're seeing in the HARP program.
Mr. Gregg.
Year over year, it may vary by, you know, 1 to 3%, but it's pretty steady for those demographics.
Increase? Steady increase?
it could go up or down, but this is around the range that it's in. We haven't seen a trend up or down in any of those.
Okay, just kind of flat. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stroink. Mr. Goff?
I have nothing right now. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Lonis Croft?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have many constituents in my constituency. It's rural Nova Scotia, and who have many reasons, basically income, that they cannot access technology. Many don't even have checking accounts. So can you explain how they would go through the process of getting this rebate?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. As I've mentioned, we won't leave anybody behind. So for those families and individuals that do not have access, the paper-based program, the manual program, will remain in place where they can access their application through access centers, the MLA office, Salvation Army, the other community groups that are involved in their local communities, and the check will be issued and mailed to them, as is the case now. So we'll ensure that for those individuals that don't have access, that the program will stay as is, which has been the case since 2009.
Okay, because you know, as you go more into the digital era, I have concerns that way. Mm-hmm. Also, we have fairly high illiteracy rates in Lunenburg County. We found ourselves in our constituency office often having to fill out applications on behalf of constituents. Is that service provided at Access Nova Scotia, where people who are functionally illiterate can go in and there's someone there to help them with their application?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our teams within Service Nova Scotia and Access Nova Scotia are there to help. There's no one that's assigned on the counter to fill out application forms for HARP, but if and when there's an ability to help, we certainly would.
Okay, because sometimes it's a hard issue to detect, mm-hmm. and often people will say, well, I'll come back, and they don't come back because there is a literacy issue there. So maybe that's an awareness that staff mm-hmm. need to have, that, and I'm sure there are pockets throughout Nova Scotia where literacy is challenging for applicants, and although they can sign their signature, they can't always comprehend what the forms are asking them. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lonis-Croft. We'll move to Mr. McGuire.
Thanks for coming in today. I wanted to talk about the reduction in advertising expenses. You mentioned Twitter and other forms of social media. Is your department moving into some of the more non-traditional forms of advertising, ones that may not be as expensive as, you know, paper and mailouts and things like that?
PG.
Ms. Monroe. And if so, are you tracking like with Twitter and social media, the amount of people that this is actually reaching, and do you have any numbers around that?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've just started our tracking this year. So yes, the analytics, the Google Analytics, are all part of this particular program. And so we are wanting to move into lower cost advertising to get larger reach and more targeted reach on the analytics. But at this point in time, I don't have any of the detailed analytics to date with me. But certainly happy to provide what we do have at this point in time to the committee. And the analysis work will happen at the end, obviously, of the HARP program and application period. So that will be something that we look at in earnest to find out how we can improve and make it better for the years to come.
What form of, and I'll just use the term non-traditional media or advertising are you using right now? Are you using Facebook? I think last I read, the average user of Facebook is over 50 years old now, and it's becoming Facebook is becoming a means for the previous generation, and with an aging population, obviously this is an important media outlet. So,
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with you. It's very important. So I'm wondering, I'd like to defer to my colleague, Mr. Gregg, to comment further on our go forward on advertising and if there's any information that he has top of mind to share with you.
Okay, we've...
Mr. Gregg?
Sorry, yes. We focused on different types of advertising. So we looked at Twitter. We've got a fairly active Twitter account. And we've looked this year at building infographics that provide, you know, a picture and a visualization. And when we spread that out through Twitter at no cost to us, we've seen, over 10,000 views of that tweet that goes out as an infographic. So we've seen a lot of success through that. We've also focused on advertisements through Facebook. And that's seen a lot of, we've got a lot of good buzz from that as well. By the end of the year, we'll be able to have some analytics done on the advertising to get some specific numbers on the reach. But we know some of the immediate feedback from Twitter has been quite strong.
What's the, just to stay on this topic for a second, what's the average cost of, say, advertising on Facebook compared to advertising in, say, one of the local media, one of the traditional newspapers or something like that? Is it about the same? Is it more? Is it less?
We've found it to be a lot cheaper, and we can be more targeted as well. We had originally focused on a large radio newspaper campaign and previous advertisements. That can get very expensive, and you don't know if you're always hitting your target audience, whereas when we can zero in on social media and online, we can target our demographic a lot better.
So you're able to target those that will more than likely apply to it the most. So would you say this is one of the reasons we've seen a little dip in the advertising cost, because you're using more effective and cost-efficient advertising methods?
Yes, we've tried to be a little more strategic with how we've spent our money and more targeted.
And you'll have numbers on that to see how many people this has impacted, how many people this has actually gotten out to?
Yes.
Okay. Have you done any studies, or have you looked to neighboring provinces in regards to their HARP programs or programs like that? Let's use New Brunswick, for example. Have you done any comparison to see where we rate compared to New Brunswick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. We always have conversations, or we look at jurisdictions when we're looking at our jurisdictional review. And in fact, we do have some information on some of the other close-by jurisdictions, I guess. If I could defer to Mr. Farmer to elaborate a bit further on that.
Yes, thank you. There's a program in place in the province of New Brunswick, and there's a program in place in Newfoundland as well, when we look at our Atlantic colleagues. The Newfoundland program is available to families with incomes up to $40,000, so a similar cutoff as to what we have in Nova Scotia, and provides assistance of $250. It provides assistance of $500 to households in coastal Labrador. So there's a slightly different parameter based on geography. And in fact, we've worked with Newfoundland to understand the efficiencies that they've introduced into their program through electronic funds transfer. They've worked with CRA, and if you get your refund deposited directly in your bank account today from CRA, the same thing happens with the program in Newfoundland. We're looking to mirror that in Nova Scotia for the next program that will begin in the fall of this year. So we've worked closely with them on that and hope to benefit from the same process that they have in place. There's also a program in place in New Brunswick. It's called the Home Energy Assistance Program, and it provides a rebate of $100 for families with incomes up to $28,000. So it's slightly less than the Nova Scotia program in terms of both the benefit and the parameters for qualification.
So it's, I guess it's safe to say that we're at the top, and compared to New Brunswick, leading the way when it comes to these types of programs.
I would say that when you look at the numbers, it's a more generous program than the program that's in place in New Brunswick, and comparable to the program that's in place in Newfoundland.
We talked about the decline in applications and enrollment. What are some of the factors besides age, income levels increasing and things like that, that lead to more or less people enrolling in this program? I mean, obviously this is a program that's very important to and has had a large impact on the people of my riding. We've seen a lot of people that come forward to the MLA's office, and the Salvation Army being across the street from me. We've seen a lot of people take advantage of this program. So what are some of the factors that would lead to a decline in enrollment in this program?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think you have to look at demographic trends where seniors are downsizing out of their homes and moving into rental properties. And if they don't pay for their heating bill, then they don't qualify. And as well, the movement of in the new build market, 80% last year of new builds were rental properties. And so if there's a demographic shift from owning your own home to renting, that will have impact as well to the numbers that would qualify or apply for the program. So those are two big things. And I guess the other one is depending on where they are in their income, and modest increase in people's salaries could put them tip them over that threshold. So those are three areas that would be areas that could impact the number of applications that we receive.
Okay, I'll pass it over. Okay, we will now, that concludes questions from the Liberal Caucus. We'll move to Mr. Houston for 14 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lots of discussion about advertising, and I'm just wondering, are you reaching the people you should be reaching? So I ask that question in the context of knowing that government has a lot of data on demographics and income and all these other heat sources and all this type of stuff, that the information that would be at the hands of government would be quite a bit. So when you see 44,000 people accessing this program, is that did you have an expectation? Should it have been higher? Should it have been less? What was your? Do you feel like you're reaching the people you should be?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think fundamentally the grassroots nature of this program is very key, and making sure that we use our community groups, Salvation Army, the MLA offices, so on and so forth. You can imagine that in some cases people might be hesitant to move forward, but if they're working with Salvation Army or one of their community groups, they might be more apt to have that information come through those kind of face-to-face conversations. On the advertising and awareness piece, our goal is to build awareness and to reach as many Nova Scotians that are
I guess that's all you're speaking about, how you reach people.
Yeah.
I'm asking a different question, and the how could have a bunch of different roads to get there, but I'm asking you, do you feel like you're reaching the right people?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The advertising spend this year, we're moving to a much more strategic, surgical, if you want, targeted advertising campaign. And we will have the analytics at the end of this particular campaign and program to do the analysis and the work to ensure that we are reaching the specific target group that we intend. And I would say that the 44,000, we've seen some declines, but that will prove out in the analytics at the end of this time around. From previous years, the print and radio advertising, you can't quite get to the same level of analytics. So the move to social and digital will help us in that regard.
So, again, that's the how. And I'm asking the question I'm asking is a lot higher than that. How many people would you expect to apply, knowing what you know, knowing what the government knows about the makeup of the population? And then I'm asking you to compare that to how many did apply. So in other words, if you had an expectation that, gee, we should be reaching 60,000 people, but we're only reaching 44, then you would retinker and advertise differently, promote differently. But if you had an expectation that we're probably going to reach, there's probably about 30 to 40,000 people, and we're reaching 44, that's a different scenario. So I'm asking you, knowing what you know, knowing what the government knows, how many people should we be reaching? And the question very specifically is, are you reaching the people you should be?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I don't have the exact number at my fingertips. This is a program that is focused on people that pay for heat. I would defer to my colleague, Mr. Gregg, on any other analysis that he might have in regards to the potential numbers that could apply.
Mr. Gregg? Sure.
Just to clarify, when you say the right people, it means we mean qualified people, people we can give a rebate to. The issue with HARP or the challenge we have is we can go to StatsCan and we can find out data for people who earn a certain amount of income. We could go and find general data for Nova Scotia from StatsCan to find out the percentage who heat with oil. But where we have a hard time is finding a percentage of qualified people who would then meet income and pay for heat. And that's the number that we're always trying to work with to figure that out. But there is no sort of clear number that can break that down for us. So we're always looking at, okay, well, what have our trends been? What's been happening over previous years? I think a major piece is sending that pre-populated application form back to everyone to receive the.
Could you not go
year.
To this is how many of the 44,000 people would you say would be on would be in the community services database that the province maintains?
How many of those 44,000 would be in?
Because I see on the form it says if you get income assistance from the Department of Community Services, no additional proof is required. So you must have some sense as to how many of your constituents, how many of the 44,000 people are also accessing community services.
Just to clarify, that was to prove income. They would still have to provide proof they paid for heat, but it's about 12% that would be in the system from income assistance.
About 12%.
But they would still have to prove that they paid for heat as well to qualify for the program.
Yeah, and again, I'm sure that information would be known to community services as well. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how you guys feel you're doing in reaching the proper audience. And it sounds like that's not really an angle that you guys have looked at it from. Would that be fair to say? You don't have an expectation of how many people would be accessing this program.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my colleague, Mr. Gregg, talked about the difficulty in understanding what your actual numbers and target group are based on the criterion. I would say we would be happy if we continue to see people applying that qualify and that we're able to reach more Nova Scotians.
So do you have a sense as to whether and are you prepared for an increase in the number of applications? Because now we have, if the government proceeds with its changes to PharmaCare, we'll have situations where people are on the guaranteed income that they'll have to now pay for their PharmaCare. They're probably going to start to look for other programs that can help them, and they would immediately be eligible for this. So, have you thought that through as to what may happen? Are you expecting in 54% of the people that use this program are seniors? Are you expecting an increase just as a result of the major changes the government is making with PharmaCare that your own application base would increase? Have you thought about that,
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As mentioned previously, we do have the budget, and the budget does have a buffer built in for increase in applications. So that would be the first thing. To date, we have an increase of around 3% of applications processed to date at this point in time. It doesn't appear to be a large volume increase on the applications being received to date. We'll certainly keep watch of that, but at this point in time, we do not have a concern that we would not be able to address all those applicants that are approved and obviously not turn any Nova Scotian away that applies and is qualifies for the program.
Okay. So the program kind of just bumps along, I guess, right? No changes to eligibility since 2009, no real changes to what's paid out, no real expectation of how many people it could and should be servicing. It just kind of happens. Is that an oversimplification of how this program works?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. I wouldn't characterize it as bump along. We always look at our programs to try to find ways to improve them and to modernize them and to make sure that they're well used. I will take the point about understanding further to Mr. Gregg's comment, is there any way that we can say and set targets, if you will, to increase that application dollar or application amount for folks coming in? But at this point, I can say that it is a focused program. We are trying to find ways, as I mentioned before, about providing an online. The online application process and looking at the requirements for that could open up a whole new avenue for new information being gathered from our applications, which we do not get now on a manual process. I do believe that the team takes great care in understanding how best to get this program out there and get the word out there and to use our stakeholders and ambassadors across the province to reach those people in need.
Thank you. Do you have any sense of how people heat their homes across the province? So you mentioned that 63% of applicants to this program use oil, 31% use electric, 6 use other, which presumably is wood, propane, I guess, natural gas.
Yeah, wood and pellets.
Okay, pellets, yeah. So, in other words, if you look at your own statistics, 63, 31, and 6, do you compare that to the basic understanding of how Nova Scotians heat their homes? Is it consistent? Or is it disproportionate? Or do you have a sense as to where that, how that fits in? Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have that information at my fingertips. I would think that it does align to the overall consumption for heat. I'm wondering if Mr. Gregg has any information in that regard? No. So we don't have that specific information with us, but we can certainly get it back to the committee at a later date.
Okay, that would be interesting. Thank you. And in terms of the actual rebates that are in place, where the $200 for oil, propane, and then $100 for electric or wood, do you hear much on the, like less than 6% of your applicants are using wood? Is it a little harder to receive this rebate if you're using wood to heat your house? Need some additional forms, and I don't know if those forms are easily accessible. Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I defer to Mr. Gregg to answer the question around the 6%?
Mr. Gregg?
Yeah, no, we always work with applicants who claim with wood because it can present some challenges. One is that applicants may purchase wood from, say, someone down the road, and they don't have a proper receipt. So we try to work with them, and that can generate follow-up sometimes because we have to, you know, be certain that this person has actually paid for heat. So we need certain information on a receipt to say the amount paid, the amount of wood received, and who it was being paid to. To try to address that, anyone who has sent out wood, who has received a rebate for wood in the previous year, we will actually send them, as part of their pre-populated application, a wood invoice form to say, here, if you can send this to your, if you're buying your wood, if you can give this to the person you're buying the wood from and have them fill it out, that's a lot easier than sending a receipt to us with incomplete information, us having to send it back, and it can cause delays and follow-up. So we try to work with them to make it as easy as possible. There's also situations where some people cut their own wood on their own land. So they're generating their own fuel, and we qualified those people as well. So we do have an additional form that if you don't have a receipt to prove you've purchased wood, but you're cutting wood from your own land, you can provide a wood declaration form and complete that and send it back to us. And that way we can provide a rebate as well.
Mr. Houston, okay. You have 1 minute remaining.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. The 2,596 people that were had their applications disallowed, you mentioned that they were mainly disallowed because they didn't meet the income eligibility. Did they self-report that they didn't meet it, or how did that? What analysis did you do on actual income reporting?
So the way our system is set up, we have an arrangement with CRA, and we will, if we submit, we receive a SIN number, the name, and we can submit that information to CRA. They'll know our income qualifications and status requirements, and it will bounce back to us if the income, it can just bounce back for us and say the income is above the threshold. For privacy reasons, we don't have access to, you know, the specifics or by how much or any of those things, because that's protected information. But it's a message we get back from CRA, so we're able to track when CRA is the cause of the decline from the information. Now, sometimes we can follow up with a person. They may follow up with us and say, "Oh, there was a mistake with my taxes, or the number's not correct, or I'm earning less this year." So people could, in fact, say if they applied in November and rejected because of income, but knew that in 2015 they received their income would qualify. They
could what line are you?
Order. We'll move now to Ms. McDonald, the NDP caucus.
Thank you. I just have a couple of quick questions, and I'll share my time with my colleague. You know, we've seen this government cut numerous tax credits and programs for vulnerable groups. The graduate retention rebate was cut, and the government claimed it didn't work. The film tax credit was eliminated with the claim that it didn't work. The seniors' pharmacare program now is under attack, as are many seniors, with the idea that the government is claiming that it's not fair and not sustainable as a program. I'm concerned that we not see another program that is important to a large number of Nova Scotians face reductions as this government goes about its business of trying to bring the province back to balance by making choices that really hurt people. So I want to ask you whether or not you think this program is working, whether or not it can be improved on, and have you recommended changes to government on the threshold, which hasn't changed for some time, so more people could qualify, and or changes in the amount of the rebate so people receive a slightly larger amount to take up the current budget allocation. So there are four questions there.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I get the questions in order. We do feel that the program is working. I would say, as I've talked about, it's a paper-based, a manual process. There's ways to make it more convenient, but also more cost-effective from an administrative perspective. So that's work that we're undertaking, and it's important to do. When we look at the thresholds, they are based off of the low income cutoff StatsCan benchmarks, and so in setting that, we are in line with the benchmarks that are used at the federal level, and we ensured as well that there wasn't a cliff that said if you hit this threshold, you're off. So there is a sliding scale that has been put in as part of the program.
I understand that, but yeah, that wasn't my question.
I think changing the thresholds and/or changing the rebates, we do know that changing the rebate by $50 can lead to two million plus in the budget. So the issue is around the balance of those priorities and reaching as many Nova Scotians as we can. There was a change that was proposed for the Good Neighbor Energy Fund, which prior last year and prior years was eligibility was for every 3 years, so individuals and families could not access GNEF other than every 3 years. We've reduced that down to 2 years now, so that does reach.
It's a great program, but it's a bit of a red herring when we're talking about the HARP program, with all due respect. So really my question is, have you made recommendations to government to change the program to improve on it, to make it more available to either more people or to improve on the rebates that people get? That's a very simple question.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As all programs, we always put recommendations forward that are considered for the broad base use of the resources of government. So, yes, we're always putting forward new ways and new approaches to government to look at the programs we have.
Have you recommended that the thresholds be changed, or have you recommended that the amount of the rebates be changed, expanded?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. As our role of public servants, our role is to put forward analysis and options for government to consider, and yes, we've done that.
And those are two of the options you've brought forward.
Ms. Monroe.
We look at many different options that we put forward on HARP, and it's there's many different levers that you can use in looking at improving programs such as HARP.
And would those be two of the options? Yes, or
yeah,
no?
Ms. Monroe?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, there's only so many levers that you can use in HARP. So, yes, thresholds would be one. Rebates would be another. Advertising would be another. How you administer the program is another.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Move to Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you ask applicants where or how they found out about the program so that you can gear the marketing and advertising and how to reach even more? Do you ask that on the application? I don't know if I've seen that through the literature I've seen or read.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I defer to Mr. Gregg to answer that question?
Mr. Gregg.
No, it can be a challenge to keep an application form as simple and as clear as possible and to fit it on the two pages as opposed to adding the two questions, adding more questions. So we don't include it on the application form. We have done commission surveys in the past. It was in about 2012 that we did that, and we looked at, people are finding out from community organizations, friends. I can get you some specific numbers from that survey if you'd like more information. As part of looking at this online modernization, we don't plan to do that in isolation of not working with the applicants. So we have plans on working with, whether through focus groups or surveys, to figure out what's the best way for this group to apply online. What's the an approach that would make it easier for them to apply online?
No, that's great, and I think it might be worthwhile to try to maybe reach out. I think it could be cost-effective to reach out. You know, since 2012, we know the numbers have continued to decrease. Has there been any discussion on making it available, a kiosk of some sort or a computer system at the Access Nova Scotia so that people can apply? I would assume you can get an application there, but is there ways of increasing maybe if they're in registering their vehicle or anything like that they could apply in the Access Nova Scotia office? Has there been any discussion potentially looking at that avenue for submitting an application?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. As we start to build out this new way of applying online, we'll certainly look at how our operations can support that. And as I mentioned before, it's not about leaving anybody behind. So we'll certainly be looking at multiple ways of expanding that modern program.
I would hope, because I know when I was in the Department of Health, one of the things that I did look at and staff looked at was the utilization of programs, especially those that kept seniors, most importantly, in their homes. So I hope that is part of the thinking and the examination as we move forward. You mentioned one of the reasons why we see a change in potentially applicants, especially with seniors, because of the decision maybe of moving into a rental unit. Has there been any discussion on the fact that even though these seniors may be selling their homes, moving into a rental unit, they're still paying for heat, even though there may not be a direct bill mailed to them? But I have to say, knowing in my own community, right across the street from my constituent office, there are four huge complexes that have seen an increase in seniors who are living there. And the rents are quite high. Many seniors go towards heat included, but that actually drives up the cost that they're paying out. Has there been any discussion on looking and evaluating, could we have a program that would help those individuals? Because they're still paying for heat. They may not have a bill from Nova Scotia Power or the person that cuts the wood or the company that provides oil or propane, but they're still paying heat. Has there been any discussion on what could we do to help, especially the seniors? I'm kind of gearing towards seniors who are taking that step now, moving into rental units. Ultimately, they still pay for heat, just maybe not as direct as if they owned their own home.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think two things to comment on there. If we remove the requirement to prove that you paid for heat, it really becomes an income-based rebate program. So it does change fundamentally the program, and that would mean that all Nova Scotians could access it. So it is a key driver for criterion for the program. The landlord, the business operator of the unit, has an opportunity to include heat as part of the rebate program that he or she has regarding operating expenses. So it would be a bit of a double dip there. So it is difficult, but fundamentally that ability to prove that you pay for your heat is a key criterion for the heating assistance rebate program.
I would hope that wouldn't limit potential future expansion of the program. I mean, I think you can put in place parameters that would require, you know, the evidence that, you know, heat is included in the rent, but you know, this is a percentage of what we're that we've increased or an owner of a building increased. But anyways, we'll leave it at that. Is there any discussion on privatizing or outsourcing this program, especially in light of Service Nova Scotia and the look at outsourcing potentially registries? Is there any discussion on outsourcing this program out of the department?
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the question. There's no specific conversation happening around outsourcing of the heating assistance rebate program.
Okay. Mr. Wilson, you have about 2 minutes remaining.
Are you sure? There's a lot of questions I have. So quickly, I guess I'll go to, since you're in front of us, I'll go to the registry and the path forward. I know that there's a roadmap project regarding the privatization of the registries. And I know my colleague, Mr. Béliveau, had sent yourself a letter asking for three specific pieces of information. And maybe I'll ask you here if you could provide it, you know, sometime in the next little while. We heard that a couple of numbers around how much it would cost to upgrade the IT system of the registry, motor vehicle, land, joint stock. Do you have an accurate number around that cost? And also, what other options beside privatization are you looking at? Would be the second question. And the third one would you know, we know that you've hired Ernst & Young as consultants regarding the registry. How much are they being paid? So I don't know if you can answer all those in 1 minute, but if not, if you could provide us the answers to that, we'd appreciate it.
Ms. Monroe.
Certainly. To modernize the registries and the numbers, it's the estimated cost at this point in time to upgrade our registry systems are around $26 to $34 million. That breaks down with the RMV system around $20 to $26 million. The RGSC system is $4 to $5 million, and the land registry system is $2 to $3 million. So these are estimates, of course, at this time, and they are subject to change as we continue to move down the path of analysis. Can you repeat the second question?
What other options beside privatization are you looking at?
Ms. Monroe.
This has been quite a journey in looking at modernizing our registries. So I would say that the work that we're doing is very complex, and it's very time-consuming.
Order.
Perhaps Mr. Wilson has asked if the questions couldn't be answered within the time, if they could be provided to the committee, so perhaps that can be done. Our clerk will follow up with you on that. We will now move along to the Liberal Caucus and Mr. McGuire.
Thank you. So I just want to go back to the forms of advertising. So the median age of Nova Scotians right now is 43.7. If you look at the billions of users that are on Facebook and Twitter, for example, that accounts for, on Facebook, 50% of all users, and on Twitter, 55% of all users. So I'm wondering if at the end of the fiscal year, I'm assuming this is one of your first years where you've done a push toward the social media side of it, if we can see the overall footprint on social media, if we can get those numbers, and the average cost per engagement compared to traditional media like newspaper and radio. Do you know what I mean? So if it costs, say, a couple hundred dollars per person for a media ad, a traditional media ad, what's the cost per social media and Twitter? Is that possible to do, you think, Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. We'll certainly be looking at that ourselves as part of that analysis work with the team. So it'll be information that I think will help us on the go forward to decide where to spend and where not to spend and where is the most effective use in looking at social media and digital, and have we reached the target group that we want. So I would say, as I look to my right to Mr. Gregg, that that would be something that we would look to share with the committee once the program is complete and the analysis has been completed.
Thanks. That'd be greatly appreciated. My last question is around the Good Neighbor Energy Program, which the changes were announced at the Salvation Army in Spryfield, which I was there for, which had a great reaction to. You've changed the criteria from 3 years down to two years for applicants. What was the thought process around that, and what kind of impact do you foresee this having on communities such as Spryfield?
Ms. Moreau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Our intent with that change is to reach more vulnerable Nova Scotians with the emergency needs. As to the analysis as to why or to how many people we might reach because of that change, if I could defer to Mr. Gregg.
Mr. Gregg.
Okay, because we've been running the program for a number of years with similar thresholds, so we've noticed that there's room to grow with this program. So where last year we had a total number of recipients of around 1,750, and it's been staying around that level for the last 3 years. We're estimating now that we can help more people, close to 2,500 people. We're thinking. Now, these are estimates, and yeah, we don't know the uptake and how our initial indications are that uptake has increased as a result of the threshold change. So,
yeah. And I just wanted to say that, one of the concerns that I heard, that I'm hearing, and I've heard in the past from constituents is access to this program, that the three-year wait is a long time to wait. So it was good that your department actually listened and dropped that from 3 to 2 years. I think it's a very positive move. And with that, I'll pass it on to my colleague,
Ms. Lohnes-Croft.
Thank you. I just want a clarification point. In order to qualify for the HEART program, you have to be living in the dwelling that you're applying for the rebate.
Ms.
So therefore, if you're in a long-term care home and you're also owning a home and you're paying heat, often through a transition while you're trying to sell it, because you're not living in the actual house, you cannot apply?
Ms. Monroe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll defer to Mr. Gregg to answer the operational question.
Mr. Gregg.
So if what the applicant would need to do is they could apply from that address, they would have to have a heating bill in their name, mm-hmm, that is sent to that home,
yes,
where they pay for heat. So if they're in the process of transitioning to a long care facility and they're still closing out the other home, as long as they're paying for heat at that address in their name, they could receive a rebate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. If there are no further questions from Liberal Caucus, our questioning is now complete. And Ms. Monroe, if you'd like to offer some closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And once again, I'd like to thank the committee members for giving us the opportunity to discuss the heating assistance rebate program. And I'd like to express the gratitude to all members of the host assembly for promoting and supporting the HARP program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Monroe. And you and your colleagues are free to leave. We do have some committee business outstanding from last week. Correspondence from Mr. Houston. As you recall, our meeting last week came to a close on time at 11 a.m., and this issue was still before the committee. Mr. Houston, you had put forward a motion, and it is stated in your January 29th letter that the motion being to extend the February 17th meeting of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts by 1 hour and invite the Minister of Health and Wellness to attend to provide clarity around changes to the seniors' pharmacare program. That motion is still before the floor. Mr. Rankin, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I do, actually. I made similar comments when this motion was on the floor the last week, and the reasoning why we can't support it. I think it's borderline out of order in terms of the way the motion is drafted. Calling in a minister to a department that is supposed to look at administration of government money spent. The person that's in charge of the administration of every department is a deputy minister, which is why that's the witness that is encouraged by the Canadian Council of Public Accounts Committee to come to public accounts. So I'd like to table a document. There's several copies here for the benefit of the members that weren't able to go to the conferences or receive training. We've had the CCAF or CCPAC group come in, I think, just once. I think we could benefit from it again. We can have a separate discussion on that, but I'll, the salient points in the document that I've looked at is that, and this you can see on our own mandate, which is online, but I'll quote page 3. Unlike most committees, they are not involved in the legislative process and do not consider legislative bills. They are supposed to focus on the administration of government programs, not on criticizing the government's policy direction. So I think PharmaCare is a blatant disregard for what that committee, what our mandate is when you're criticizing policy. And I don't think there's any problem with criticizing policy. I'm questioning the arena in which you do that in. And I understand that the opposition, with the host not sitting, that they need to try to find any mechanism they can to challenge that policy. But given the fact that PharmaCare, the changes are not going to be introduced until April 1st, and that's assuming that they're not going to change between now and then. So, again, I have no problem with asking for information from departments. I don't think you need Public Accounts Committee to do that as the channel. Page 23 specifically says to discourage ministers from sitting on the PAC as members and appearing before PAC as witnesses. So that's for the reasons that I've already mentioned. These are best practices that are shared nationally. It's pretty black and white there, and policy discussions are left to other legislative committees. Now, I recognize we don't have a health committee, and that's a symptom of why a lot of the major health issues are coming in. But that does not mean that we should usurp the primary mandate of what the public accounts is for. I'll also read a quote from the chair of the Yukon PAC. We are a nonpartisan committee with a mandate to ensure economy, efficiency, and effectiveness in public spending. In other words, accountability for the use of public funds. Our task is not to challenge government policy, but to examine its implementation. I know there's a proclivity to always challenge the policy when we're in a partisan arena, but the whole idea of the training of this and to make a better committee is to try to act in what they call constructive partisanship. You have your own tendencies and your own ideas of how policy should be drafted. And I'll end with just reading one more thing on the constructive partisanship, which is on page 36. It explains the importance of constructive working relationships with a focus on improving the administration of government policy rather than focusing on the policy itself. So obviously there's issues with supposed policy, and there's a presupposition of how that policy impacts people. All I'm saying is that if we bring in ministers, we're getting in the political hyperpartisan realm, and it's pretty clear from what I've learned, and I know I haven't been around that long, but I know that that is supposed to be in the chamber and left to budget estimates. If you have a political question, your question policy, that goes to the minister. And again, I'm not challenging that. Those are two separate issues. I'm challenging the arena in which those issues are brought forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin. Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank Mr. Rankin for his comments and research on the issue. But, you know, the motion before us is to have the minister attend here to discuss the PharmaCare changes. Now, Mr. Rankin makes the point that this is not the place to discuss policy. But I think the part that's lacking from that argument is it's when you look at the number of policies across government, a policy is not a policy is not a policy. The PharmaCare program is a very significant program that impacts every single Nova Scotian. And there's a historical portion to that program where historically the PharmaCare program was funded 25% by seniors, 75% by taxpayers. And over time, that has kind of eroded a little bit, let's say, where I think the numbers that the deputy minister, to the extent that the deputy minister was willing to answer the questions of this committee, which was very limited, the degree of questions he would answer. He did say that the program cost $166 million last year and seniors paid, I think, $53. So if you do that math, you can see how that historical relationship is changing. And it's clear to me, and I think it's clear to most Nova Scotians, that this government is proposing changes to dramatically alter that historical relationship. So I think that if in the context of that alone, if the Liberal Party wants to produce documentation that says it's only deputy ministers that can come here and answer questions, then the least they could do is support us when deputy ministers appear before this committee and refuse to answer questions. Then the very least the Liberal Party could do is support us when we put our hand up and say, hold on, this committee deserves an answer. And in this case specifically, not one member from the Liberal side put their hand up and said, why isn't the deputy minister answering these questions? And in fact, they went a step further last week when my colleague asked this committee to request additional documentation supporting what the deputy minister not told us in response to a question, but told the media. When we said we need more information, these Liberal members stood up in their place one by one and said, no, no, this committee will not get more information on this. So we can't have our cake and eat it too, I think is the expression, Mr. Chair. So I would say that we need more information about the PharmaCare changes. People are concerned about the PharmaCare changes. They are, if you listen to the government sound bites, they will be, changes will go live April 1st. April 1st, not that far away, Mr. Chair. And there's so much unknown about the impact of these changes. What are the changes? Who do they impact? Who do they not impact? So I would be disappointed if my colleagues on this committee don't see the significance of the changes on Nova Scotians and aren't willing to help Nova Scotians get more information about this very significant change, which is happening in real time. So I'll be interested to see if the Liberal members can look past some precedences which are probably not even relevant to what we're talking about here and inject a bit of common sense into this and support the motion. The deputy minister was here. He wouldn't answer our questions. So where do we turn? We have to turn to the minister. And that is the context in which I propose this motion. So I'm hopeful that the Liberal members will support more information for Nova Scotians, instead of advocating for less information for Nova Scotians. So the motion to have the minister appear next week, it's a very convenient time, his staff will all be here anyway. We've heard very little from this minister on this issue. We've had a premier say, not that the changes are wrong, but the way the changes were communicated were wrong. It's an age-old political game, Mr. Speaker, in the discussion of partisanship. It's what we're seeing, and I would hope that the members will support the minister coming and answering questions about his changes.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson, and then Mr. Rankin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we do support this motion. Our committee in Nova Scotia, Public Accounts Committee, has been recognized, I believe, as a progressive public accounts committee, not only in Canada, but in the Commonwealth. We've been recognized as leaders, and we know that from the visits we have, from the discussions I've had over the last, not 12 years, but I've been on this committee for close to 9 years. And I believe we are looked upon as leaders because we continue to kind of change and adapt our committee and aren't afraid of the old conventions or changing the conventions of the committee. And I recall a couple of changes over the last 12, 13 years that I think have improved the work that we do as a committee. One was, I believe, the rule for many years was that no leader of a recognized party would sit on the committee. We know in, I believe it was the early 2000s, under the Liberal Party, Danny Graham chose to sit on the committee, and it was accepted, and he contributed immensely to this committee. And I have to turn to my left and say that our leader has contributed a lot, not only as former chair of this committee, but as a member. We've had precedences in this committee where we've had former members and current members testify. I recall Dr. Hamm being here. I recall Ernie Fage being here. So I do believe that we need to continue to move forward, and when we come up to roadblocks or come across roadblocks like we did a number of weeks ago or last week with the Deputy Minister, that it's paramount. We and I believe Nova Scotians would want us to do everything we can to make sure that we have the right information in front of us, and I believe at this time it's the Minister that could provide us with that information. So we will support the motion from my colleague.
Mr. Rankin.
I guess that's just more hyper-partisanship, to be honest. Like, the words that they're using are proposing policy says it right there, that this is not the committee for it. So, and the tone even used, these Liberal members are voting against a motion that denies people access to information, is the most partisan you can get for what we're trying to achieve in this committee. Where's the report? I mean, a good litmus test is, what would the Auditor General look like? If he's looking at a report, what are we analyzing? Where's the money spent on this proposed new policy? You're looking at economic forecasts. And again, that's a separate issue. If you want the information, email the department. Every time I've contacted the department, they've been forthcoming with any information that I wanted. So why do you want to try to drag it in and obfuscate what the Public Accounts Committee is meant for?
Thank you, Mr. Rankin. So we do have before us, there will be a motion put to a vote. But we do have, just to summarize, Mr. Rankin has provided a recommendation from the Canadian Council of Public Accounts Committees, which states that public accounts committees should avoid bringing ministers to committees. We have a legal opinion from our legal counsel that the committee may invite a minister but cannot compel or subpoena a minister to appear. If the minister refuses to appear, the committee may refer the matter to the House, which may then order the member to appear. And certainly the minister can appear voluntarily. The meeting next week, being February the 17th, is with the Department of Health and Wellness, the topic being mental health programs, services, and strategy. The motion before the committee by Mr. Houston is that the Minister of Health attend that meeting, that the meeting be extended for 1 hour
so that questions can be asked and the minister can answer to provide clarity around changes to the seniors' pharmacare program. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? There's been a call for a recorded vote. We will begin with Mr. Rankin. We will proceed in a counterclockwise direction. I am actually going to vote when it comes to me for the ease of our audiovisual services. Mr. Rankin, please answer yes or no.
No.
Mr. Houston.
Yes.
Ms. McDonald.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
I will vote yes.
No.
Mr. McGuire. Ms. Lohnes-Croft.
No.
Mr. Goff.
No.
Mr. Stroink.
No.
The motion has been defeated. Ms. McDonald, do you have a comment? Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to, in the interest of maybe trying to find some common ground on this, put forward a motion that the committee invite the Deputy Minister of Seniors to appear in front of the committee next week as an additional hour for our committee. So we would keep our agenda as established, but we would meet for an additional hour, and not with a minister, but with the Deputy Minister for Seniors, who has been meeting with the seniors organizations with respect to the pharmacare situation.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Mr. Rankin, you have a comment. Mr. Rankin.
Yes, my comment would be is we had agenda setting 3 weeks ago. That was the opportunity to bring topics forward. And even pharmacare could have been a topic if you want to analyze past expenditures with the program, but that wasn't put forward by the opposition. So I don't think it's, you can't just come every meeting and propose new topics. That's what agenda setting's for. So I don't think that motion's in order.
Mr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I definitely support the motion. For the simple, I mean, in the time that I've been on this committee, which admittedly is not that long, but going back, I don't think it's been the practice of members of this committee to just show up and try and put topics on the agenda. Mr. Rankin says whenever something's in the news, we try to do that, and I would certainly challenge him to go back. I mean, the difference here is, this is a very significant change that's impacting a lot of Nova Scotians, and it's causing a lot of angst in the community. It's a very timely issue. And the Nova Scotians deserve information on it, and I'm just surprised that in the existence of an obvious vacuum of information. I haven't heard the Minister of Health talk about this since the day he said this was a wonderful thing. I haven't heard him say one word about it. I haven't heard anyone from the government say anything about this policy, other than maybe we made a mistake in a letter. You know, Mr. Chair, there's information that's needed. This committee has a chance to step up and help get information to Nova Scotians in the face of an absence of it. And to say that, well, the opposition shows up every week and tries to put a new topic on, that's just not true. This is an important social issue of our time. It's very timely, and we have an opportunity to provide service to Nova Scotians, and I think we should take that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Houston. The motion before the committee, and after conferring with legal counsel, the motion is in order. Motions can be put forth like this, so it must go to a vote. Those in favor of Ms. McDonald's motion, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed? Motion is defeated. It's a request for a recorded vote. We will again follow the same order. I will begin with Mr. Rankin.
No.
Mr. Houston.
Yes.
Ms. McDonald.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
I will vote yes. Mr. McGuire.
Nope.
Ms. Lohnes-Croft.
No.
Mr. Goff.
No.
Mr. Stroink.
No.
Motion has been defeated. Our next meeting is February 17th with the Department of Health and Wellness to discuss mental health programs, services, and strategy. Mr. Stroink.
Just want to make one comment before we have the next meeting. I ask that the chair and the vice chair and Mr. Pickup have a discussion just based on the questionings of what kind of questions can be asked. He had the great fortune to meet with a lot of the other public accounts colleagues across Canada. I mean, my issue is we bring in ministers or deputy ministers about a topic that we've set as an agenda, and then questions veer quite dramatically off those topics. A lot of the times those deputy ministers aren't prepared for that. I personally don't. The ability to ask questions on whatever topic is totally allowed, I think, but at the same time, we have to allow for deputy ministers to have time to collect themselves and be ready for questions. So next week is on mental health. I am sure, based on this conversation here, the questions are going to veer very off that topic. I just want some direction from the chair, Mr. Pickup, and the vice chair on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stroink. We have met in the past on that, and we will aim to do something by... Sorry, Mr. Stroink?
He just met with them last week or a couple of weeks ago on this in, I don't know, somewhere in Canada where they all have met. Just to follow up on that, that's all I ask.
Thank you, Mr. Stroink. We will do that. I will state, we just have a minute left, and I certainly respect your point. This committee, of course, though, does operate based on its legislative mandate, which is independent of meetings the Auditor General might have. So I'm not saying that to refute your point. I think you make a relevant point. It's something we will discuss. And certainly, if any time members feel a question is out of order, they're free to object. And we will make a ruling in council with our legal counsel. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.